Well, thank you very much, Steve. Thanks for making this possible, as well as for everyone from Zeichmann's for doing this, setting this up. I always enjoy these series. They make me look at topics that otherwise it's very easy to sort of deal with in an up-in-the-air way, to suddenly have to deal with them in a practical way, like, okay, so what do you do in this circumstance? I do ask that people make sure to sign in with their email addresses. The point of the email address is that I can follow up afterwards on questions and issues that come up during the class, and also that I can send you the source sheet in advance of the next topic. Good enough. I'm not offering psak, I'm not offering halachic rulings on any of these issues. I'm just discussing issues that come up, and if you have a practical question, that goes to the rabbi of your shul. Okay. The question that I wanted to look at this week and next week, because really it's sort of one merged class, is a basic ethical question of, I am obligated to be ethical personally. I have a responsibility to promote ethical behavior, but what are the limits of my obligation to promote ethical behavior? Am I expected to change the world? Am I expected to change the world by force? When I know that people around me are doing things that are inappropriate, what exactly is the extent of my responsibility? So what we'll talk about for today, I hope, is first the case of a friend in which you know someone is going to do something that you believe to be unethical. Then the case of someone with which one did I use? The case of someone right with whom you work, and or really a client of yours engaging in something unethical where you are more involved, and then the next two vignettes I want to use in the next session will involve more hands-on cases, more hands-on involvement. So we're sort of building up. I'm going to stipulate two things in order to expedite this. Number one is I'm going to stipulate that certain unethical business activities are prohibited under Jewish law, meaning you could have a great discussion about the extent to which Jewish law actually covers the cases we're talking about, but if we did that, we would never have time to cover anything else. So I'm stipulating that signing one's name to a false tax return, lying on forms in general, cheating customers, those things are bad in the eyes of halacha. That's number one. Number two is I'm bypassing the issue of reporting to secular authorities when you believe a Jew has done something wrong, the topic called mesira. It's a great topic, but I don't think we're going to get there. We might at the end of next week's session. We'll see how things are going. But there's just so much else that we need to cover. So we start with the case that I called on the sheet, non-professional advice. And here's the vignette. Sarah is a certified tax accountant. Anyone named Sarah working in taxes here? No? Okay. Sarah is a certified tax accountant. Her friend Rachel asks her, thanks, for offline advice on how to best report her earnings. Sarah advises her, but comes out of the conversation believing that Rachel is going to cheat on her forms, just based on the flow of the conversation. Is Sarah halakhically obligated to pursue Rachel and convince her to obey the law? Can she say, I wash my hands of this? Or does she have a responsibility to do something further to encourage her friend to comply with the law? What would you say? You would say no? Okay. Anybody say yes? We have a yes. Now we have a debate. What's the reason for saying no? Let's provide the no argument first. Why am I not obligated? In other words, we accept that we have to act ethically. Why does that not extend to convincing others to act ethically? Right. So she's, number one, she's an adult. She's capable of making her own decisions. Right? And number two, you're saying, if I heard you correctly, that she's aware of what she's doing. It's not a case of ignorance.
Correct.
Okay. Good arguments. Jonah, what would you say in response?
Well, first we have Kol Yisrael Ariven Zebazeh.
Kol Yisrael Ariven Zebazeh. So that means that all Jews are responsible for each other. You're assuming then that Rachel is Jewish.
Yes.
Because I named her Rachel.
And
okay, fine.
If she is Jewish and the other person is not Jewish, if she's giving off a negative image of Jews.
Mm. So there's an issue potentially of Chilul Hashem, of the way that Judaism is going to be portrayed if you are somehow not going to object to unethical conduct. Okay. Except that the other person involved is approving of unethical conduct, effectively, right? So they don't see this as a problem. It's actually an interesting point. In other words, if I convey a proper impression to Judaism to somebody, which will sound to them like I'm approving unethical conduct, is that Chilul Hashem? That's actually not so clear cut. But hey, these are both reasonable perspectives. Yes.
I guess there's also a line. Like, even if you think you should encourage, what does that mean to encourage? You tell them you should word it correctly, so you're encouraging them. And like, how much further do you have to go? Like, how much more?
Right.
Like, I mean, what point do you say? I mean, even if you think you have obligation to encourage them, where does that end?
Right. So the question really is, what does encourage even mean? Does, you know, when we say convince her to obey the law, does that mean picket her house? Does that, you know, mean say, well, I'm never going to see you again? What would be involved in convincing you to?
Well, just reading the words as you raise this case, this is speculative. She doesn't know that she can break the law. She's,
correct.
She believes there might be some chance. Doesn't know with certainty. So, you know, the question right. is that make you fight differently? As you know, she has proof that she can do something wrong.
Correct. So that's a major point here. This friend Rachel has said nothing explicit. She believes that that's what she's going to do. She doesn't. It's not as though she has a form in front of her and she sees that things are entered incorrectly. That far we didn't go with this case. So let's talk about this. The first issue, the first legal issue that could come up is one I'm going to dismiss out of hand, and that's one called Lifnei Iver. Shorthand for Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michshol. Don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind. The rule is that I'm not allowed to do things that are going to cause people to make mistakes or to act inappropriately. The reason why I'm going to discard that here, it's not relevant in this case, is because here, as was said before, Sarah gave Rachel appropriate advice. It's not an issue of ignorance. There's no one who is blind. If Rachel chooses to do whatever she's doing, it's not because Sarah didn't tell her the truth. So there's no issue here of Lifnei Iver, of keeping her from stumbling. What is involved is a combination of two issues, which are closely related. One is an active mitzvah called Tochacha. Tochacha, usually rendered as rebuke, it means to demonstrate or to show somebody proper behavior. That's number one. And then number two, related to that, is a principle of Afrushe Me'isura, which means separating people from prohibitions. And there's a difference between the two, but they are related, as we'll see. These are the issues that come up. They stem from a basic philosophical understanding of the goal of the Jew in this world. My goal, when I am put here on earth, is not simply to fulfill my checklist, where, you know, God says to me, here's your list of 613, here are the ones that are not relevant to you, because you're not a Kohen, and you're not a king, and all that, so here's your subset of the 613, and make sure that by the time you're done here, you put checks in as many boxes as possible. That's not the limit of my existence here. Part of my existence here is about being a person who sanctifies God's name in the world, which includes encouraging proper behavior. That's the one side. On the other hand, that doesn't necessarily mean coercing others into cooperating so that I can fulfill my mission of spreading God's name in the world. So that's what this is fundamentally about, is my obligation to promote proper actions as I see them. So take a look at source number one, please. Classic. It's a sentence in Vayikra and Leviticus. Lo sisna es achicha bilvavecha. Do not hate your brother in your heart. Hocheach tochiach es amisecha. You shall rebuke your friend. Velo sisa alav chet, and do not bear sin for him. Suggesting that in the event that he sins, and yet he does something wrong because I didn't rebuke him, it's going to be my sin as well. If I don't rebuke, I am guilty. And then the sentence continues. I brought the extension in the Hebrew where it says, you shall not take revenge or bear a grudge. You should love your neighbor as yourself. But the key is the part that I translated, in which we are told that there is an obligation for the Jew, lehochiach, to, again, we usually render as rebuke. What does lehochiach actually mean? To prove. Where do you get that from? How do you know that that's the shoresh? No, I'm asking.
Lehit vakeach, maybe.
Well, lehit vakeach is to debate.
Same root, no?
No, it's not.
No. I'm not sure that it's not. I'm not sure they're not related, but I would draw on its use in the Torah in the incident between Yaakov and his brother-in-law, Lavan. Right? Yaakov is working for Lavan, and he manages to increase Lavan's flocks, and he says, I want my salary for it. And he says, Es oniva es yikia kapaira elokim vayochach vayochach amesh. He says, God saw how I worked so hard for you, and by providing me with reward for my work, it says, vayochach amesh. He demonstrated it yesterday, last night. So vayochach is used there, same root as tochacha, to mean demonstration. So that's a decent translation of it. The problem tends to be that the works that deal with this mitzvah of tochacha tend to use the word tochacha in the translation, in the definition. I brought you an example in source number 2, the work called Sefer HaChinuch, which outlines all of the commandments in the Torah, begins by saying the mitzvah is lehochiach echad miYisrael she'eino mitnahei kashura, to mochiach a Jew who doesn't act properly. So he just defines the word as itself. That doesn't help me a whole lot, but it means to demonstrate what is correct. And this is actually considered to be very broad, so that the Rabbi Yaakov Kanievsky, the stipler, in his work Yehilos Yaakov, said even if a person is simply not fulfilling his potential. He's not violating any laws, but he's not doing as much as he could. There is a mitzvah of rebuke, tochacha, demonstration, whatever you want to call it, to help that person to see that he could be doing more. Yes, Dori.
But rebuke and demonstration are two different things.
Not that.
No, go ahead.
Like rebuke would be to, you know, at least my understanding of the word would be to go out and to oppose something. Where demonstration would be to act it yourself in hopes that that others emulate after your behavior, as opposed to actively going and disagreeing with an action of someone else.
Right. There's more than one way to demonstrate, whereas we do take rebuke to be sort of frontal criticism.
Right.
I think that is the way we tend to look at it. And people tend to define tochacha fairly narrowly in the rebuke sense, although I agree that there's more to it. It's a very difficult thing to do properly. I brought you source number 3, in which Rabbi Tarfon says, he says, I would be stunned, tameahani, im yesh b'dor hazeh shemekabel tochacha. He says, I would be stunned if anyone in this generation would accept rebuke. Because im amar lo tol kisei mi bein enoch, amar lo tol karo mi bein enoch. If he would say to somebody else, take a splinter from between your eyes, the person will respond, take a beam from between your eyes. Meaning that people will just respond by saying, well, you're more flawed than I am. Parenthetically, I don't know how many people here are familiar with it, but this also appears in Christian teachings. It's not a Jewish-specific statement. This back and forth, where I say, take a splinter from between your eyes, the person responds, take a beam. But Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah says, the flaw is not necessarily with the recipient of the rebuke. The flaw may be with the rebuker. He says, to me, honey, I would be stunned if anyone in this generation would know how to rebuke. Meaning, this has to be done really well. This is hard to do. When we speak of an obligation, and we say, well, Sarah, you may be obligated to convince Rachel to obey the law, that's not simple and straightforward, and as a matter of fact, the Talmud discusses refraining from it if you don't know what you're doing. It's not simple and straightforward, keeping in mind, you only fulfill the goal if you actually get the person to do what's right. Meaning, if all I do is yell at him, but I don't register anything, then what have I accomplished? can I really check that off and say I fulfilled my obligation to rebuke? If all I did was yell in an unconstructive way at somebody, I need to be able to do something that's going to have a chance of succeeding. Otherwise, what was the purpose? But keep that in mind. That's one issue, is this issue of tochacha. There's a second issue. And the second issue is what we call afrushe me'isura, separating people from sinning. Take a look, please, at source number 4, which comes from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. The first part of it will be Rabbi Yosef Karo writing in Turkey. Well, he went from Turkey to Tzfat in the end of the 15th century, beginning of the 16th. And then the second part, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, he's writing in Krakow about 20 years later. So, first, Rabbi Karo says, Haroa kilayim shel Torah al chaveiro. The Torah prohibits wearing what we call shatnez. Shatnez is a mixture of wool and linen, so that my clothing should not contain mixtures of wool and linen. Why? Good question. All sorts of different explanations are offered for something which the Torah itself generally says, just accept it. It's not something that we're going to present you with a rationale as to why, but don't wear wool and linen clothing. So what happens if you see somebody else wearing wool and linen clothing? What do you do? So he says, if you see him wearing what I call in the translation biblical shanes, meaning something that violates the biblical prohibition. Even if the guy's walking out of the market, he's out in public, he should jump up and remove it from him immediately. Even if it's his mentor, even if it's his rabbi, he says you have to get rid of this immediately. He's violating biblical law. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, though, says not so fast. He says, V'yesh omrim dim haya halovesh shogeg ein tzarech lasos bashuk. He says some say that if the person who's wearing it is doing so accidentally, then you don't have to remove it from him in the market in public. Dimishum kavod abrios shigishtok, because there's a matter of the dignity of human beings. And so he says, be silent at that point. Val yafrishenu mishogeg. Don't keep him from his accidental error. Yes?
How does that fit into the normal basement system? Bringing up someone on whatever charges and having witnesses, how can you have both systems of, seemingly vigilantism, which is allowed, and having the formal process?
Right. So I think that the way this is looked at is that it's not punishment. It's not a matter of hurting the person, although I mean, he's going to be embarrassed. But it's not a matter of imposing a penalty on him. It's a matter of saying, right now, he is flouting God. We have a Torah that says, don't do this. And he's walking around in public, telling the world, I am doing this. And we're saying that it's where it's intentional. So I'm going to stand up and say, don't do this in public. Now, whether I'm saying to do this nowadays or not is a separate thing, okay? But I'm explaining to you the way the Shulchan Aruch is presenting it. This is something that is hotly debated to this day. I mean, when you have people standing up and demonstrating in various cities in Israel because someone is driving a car on Shabbos, it's all an outgrowth of this and a question of how do I fit this into the way I conduct myself in 2012. But that's the guideline he's giving you is, if a person is violating biblical law, and he knows he's violating biblical law, you have a responsibility to make it stop. Now, what is the rationale behind it? The principle of afrushe me'isura, keeping somebody from sin. Where does that come from? There is no sentence in the Torah that says, keep people from sinning. So, what exactly is the sort, other than the rebuke mitzvah? But this isn't rebuke, right? It isn't even demonstration. This is something different. This is something apart. So, there are three different schools of thought as to where this comes from. One, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, in source number 5. He says, Davka l'Yisrael mitzvah l'hafrisho me'isura. He starts out by saying that this is only an obligation when it comes to Jews, meaning there are commandments for Jews, there are commandments for people who are not Jewish. The mitzvah of keeping somebody from sinning is only an obligation for Jews. That they have to keep other Jews from sinning. Why? D'chol Yisrael arevin zeh bazeh. Because all Jews are responsible for each other. He gets this from the idea that's expressed Talmudically based on sentences in the Torah regarding the covenant the Jews make before they enter Israel, in which they are told that they are all going to be responsible for the sins of the nation. The Haniglos Lashem Elokeinu, that which is revealed is for Hashem to take care of. Hanistaros Lashem Elokeinu, that which is hidden is for God to take care of. Haniglos, but that which is revealed is for all of us to take care of. So based on that, we have a principle that Jews are responsible for each other's actions. But if someone isn't Jewish and he's going to do something wrong, he says that far it doesn't go. Even in terms of their own prohibitions, ain kan arevus. There is no joint responsibility. He says, assuming you're not misleading them into sinning, you're not allowed. In other words, one of the biblical mitzvot is for someone who isn't Jewish, he's not allowed to steal. So I am not allowed to do something that's going to lead him into stealing. That would be lifnei iver, causing the blind to stumble. Assuming he didn't know any better. I'm not talking about what he does. So I can't cause him to steal. However, if I didn't cause him to steal, I am not, says the Chasam Sofer, obligated to stop him from stealing. So I'm walking past the house at night, and I see somebody about to break in. So, leaving aside my obligations towards the residents of the house, pretend that doesn't exist. I have to ask him, are you Jewish? Right? If he says, I'm not Jewish, then you say, okay, have a good night, and you keep on walking. If he says, actually, I am a Jew, then you say, well, then I have to convince you not to break into this house. Because afrushe mei yisura, I have to keep you from sinning. That may be an extreme case. But this principle of arevus, of joint responsibility, is a very important one. Because that's what allows me, also, on a positive side, to perform mitzvot on behalf of others. Right? When you're, let's say, after davening is over in shul, Shabbos morning, right? Then someone stands up and makes kiddush, and everybody else answers amen, and it's as though they had made kiddush. Right? Why does that work? Same principle of arevus. We have joint responsibility, or arevut. We have joint responsibility, each of us for the other, and in the event that I do a mitzvah, that's part of his mitzvah, and in the event that I do something wrong, it's part of his wrongdoing, and therefore he has a responsibility to keep me from sinning. So that's one possible source for this. A second possible source is in number 6. This is actually the son of Rabbi Moshe Sofer from source number 5. Rabbi Avram Shmuel Binyamin Wolf Sofer offers a different explanation. He says, "Uladati, in my view, Dabar Zed De'oraisahu Me'ocheach Tochiach." He says the obligation to keep people from sinning is a biblical obligation based on the mitzvah, in fact, of rebuke. If someone's going to listen, you have an obligation to tell him to keep him from accidental error. Now, note the caveat. Only, he says, when someone is going to listen. Yes?
So in this case of the shotness,
yeah.
Do we assume that the person wearing it is conscious that they're wearing shotness?
Right, so that's where Moshe Isserlis' comment. It's only if it's intentional.
Right.
Yeah. That's correct.
But you never know, really, if someone's going to listen. So that, to me, is a big sort of gray area. So, for example, Rachel's case here is Sarah. Sarah's talked to Rachel. You know, and she told her, you know,
yeah.
You don't know. In other words, if you do this really strictly and say your obligation is only when you're very confident or reasonably confident that your rebuke is going to have some help, some effect, otherwise you're not obligated to do it at all. In most cases, that's going to be the case.
Yep. So I'm going to come back to that.
She asked her how to do it to her best advantage.
After that, she's doing it herself. This is, you know, this is non-professional advice. You're not finishing the return for her. She says, "Thank you very much. Now I'm going to do this my way." But it's a good question. I'm going to come back to it in a couple of minutes. That's the second possible source for the obligation to keep people from sin. The third possible approach is that it's actually a function of the mitzvah we mentioned earlier, lifnei iver, not to cause people to stumble. Where if you take a look at source number 7, Tosfot is a set of comments from the 13th century, different sages in France and Germany, by and large, on the Talmud. They're describing a case in which, well, take a step back. There's a prohibition against transport on Shabbat from a private domain into a public domain, like from my house out of the house. So what happens if the following happens? Somebody who is needy, has no food, comes to my house and says, I would like some food. I say to him, here's some food. It's out there on a plate. He takes the food from the house and brings it out of the house. So he has violated Shabbat by transporting from the house outside. Have I violated any law by putting him in a position to do that? Do I have an obligation to say, don't take that out of the house because you're going to be violating Shabbat? So take a look at source number 8, number 7, I'm sorry, in which Tosfot says, Afilu mayri shayachol litlo. Even if he could take it on his own, so therefore I didn't. It's not that I enabled him to sin. Afilu haya biado, delo avar mishum lifnei iver. Even if there is no issue of causing the blind to stumble, because he could have taken it on his own, it's not me putting it in his hand that caused him to do it. Even still, mikol makom isur derabbanan miha ika shechayv lachvisho meisur. There's a rabbinic prohibition as a function of not causing the blind to stumble. I should not put him in a position to take this thing out of my house. So, three different explanations for why I have an obligation to keep someone from sinning. One explanation is arevut, joint responsibility, we're all responsible for each other. A second explanation is a function of tochacha, this mitzvah of rebuke. And then the third approach is that it's under this lifnei iver rule of not causing people to stumble. Those are the different approaches. So based on this, if I stopped here, right, would Sarah be obligated to convince Rachel, you know, say, don't do that. Don't do what you're going to do. I could argue yes, under the principle of rebuke, under the principle of keeping somebody from sinning. However, we've already seen the root of what may be her way out. Number one, I'm changing the case slightly. If Rachel isn't Jewish. Let's say Rachel is not Jewish. We've already seen the mitzvah of rebuke phrased in the Torah as Hocheach Tochiach Es Amisecha in source number 1, which I loosely translated as rebuke your friend. The truth of the matter is that Amit doesn't really mean friend. I don't know a great translation for it in English, like a one-worder. Member of the covenant may be sort of a translation, but the point is, it ends up applying specifically to Jews. Rashi notes that in source number 8. I'm not going to read it inside, just in the interest of time. But he says, your responsibility of rebuke is only to Jews. There is a view, the Sefer Hasidim, Rabbi Yehuda Chassid says, well, you know, if you can rebuke, you should. After all, look at the book of Yonah. God sends Yonah to go rebuke the people of Nineveh. They're not Jewish. So there is a concept of correcting people even if they are not Jewish. But nonetheless, the halachic obligation of tochacha, of rebuke, really is Jew-specific. Whether it actually keeps Jews from telling other people what to do is another story. But theoretically, your obligation to tell people what to do is only to Jews. What about this issue of afrushe meisura, keeping people from sinning? So, the last source comes from Rabbi Shabtai HaKohen, his commentary to the Code of Jewish Law. He's dealing with a very interesting case. The question is this. I am a marketer of spices and incense and that sort of thing. And someone comes to me who I believe is going to use this incense for his form of worship, which I don't recognize. It's not worship of God. As I understand it, it's worship of something else. Is there anything to stop me from selling it to him? So he says here, Kulei Alma Modim, in the particular case he's discussing, which is more nuanced than the one I just mentioned, but I just gave that as an example, he says, all agree with the positions outlined by the Mordechai and Tosfot, two earlier commentators, the Ba'ovei Kochavim Omumar Shari. You can sell this incense that he's talking about to an idolater, meaning someone who isn't Jewish, or to a Mumar. A Mumar is a Jew who sins intentionally. I'm going to come back to that turn of phrase. Right now, the only reason that I brought it is for the first part of it, in which he says that there is no mitzvah of keeping someone from sinning If he isn't Jewish, as we said earlier from the Chatam Sofer, he says my joint responsibility is only going to apply to other Jews. So therefore, in the event that your friend who asked for the tax advice is not Jewish, it would seem you have to give him good advice. You're not allowed to mislead him. You're not allowed to mislead him. Jew, non-Jew doesn't make a difference. But going the extra mile of, and I'm going to pursue him to make sure he does what's right, that is only among your family. That's an obligation that doesn't go beyond that. That's one. The second out, and this goes back to Steve's question about what you know and don't know in this circumstance, is you don't have a responsibility to... Well, actually, I'm going to come back to you guys a little bit later. But you don't have a responsibility to someone you know is violating intentionally. If they know what they're doing, then it's not your issue, potentially. Why? Look at that language in source number 9. Rabbi Shabtai Cohen, also known as the Shach. His last word, the Mumar. He says, you would be allowed to sell it, this material that's used for idolatry, to a Mumar. A Mumar is a Jew who says, I'm not going to follow Torah. Why am I allowed to sell a Jew something he's going to use for a violation? Who cares but whether he personally follows Torah or not? Why am I permitted to sell it to the Mumar? Sorry?
This is prerogative.
You do it anyway, so it's not your...
This is prerogative, not yours.
Well, he's going to do it anyway. That means he's not blind.
Give you to
right.
Any change in his behavior. Well,
he's right. Not responsible for their actions.
No.
So one way to look at it, I mean, there are different views you can take on it, but one view on it is presented in source number 10, the top of the second side. Rabbi Aryeh Ginsberg, known for his work on the Talmud Turei Eben, also known for his work Shagat Aryeh, work of responsa, says, Vaday kol Yisrael mitzuvan la'afrish ovrei avera min ha'avera. He says, certainly all Israel are obligated to separate people who sin from sinning, bidde efshar, where it is possible. Those are key words. Mishum achi mechuyav l'hafrish katan. That's why we have a mitzvah of, if you see a minor eating something non-kosher, you're supposed to stop him from doing so, because you can. Kevin de efshar l'hafrishav. Aval hacha, in his case that he's discussing, which is a separate case, that's not one we've seen so far, askinim b'dalo efshar. You're talking about where it's not possible, then you don't have an obligation of afrushi me yisura. If the guy isn't going to listen to you, then there's nothing for you to do. And based on that, if you've given your advice, and they've said, thank you very much, now I'm going to do what I'm going to do, then this issue of afrushi me yisura may not apply. Now, that's as far as keeping somebody from sinning. What about the mitzvah of rebuke? And then I'm going to summarize what we've said so far, but what about the mitzvah of rebuke? So the answer is, that this on this there's a debate. And it goes back to a story in the Gemara. The story in short form, based on passage that appears in the book of Yechezkel, of Ezekiel, in which, as the Talmud understands what's going on, God decrees he's going to make a plague and strike down the wicked. He turns to an angel and says, I want you to write a letter tough. Tough is the last letter in the Hebrew alphabet. I want you to write a tough in blood on the heads of the wicked and in ink on the heads of the righteous. However, there's a response from a force of justice which turns to God and says, well, what's the difference between the two groups? And God says, well, these are good and these are not good. Right? These did the right thing and these didn't do the right thing. To which the angel says, yeah, but those who did the right thing didn't rebuke the others. They just worried about themselves. They didn't watch out for what other people were doing. To which God says, yeah, but those other people wouldn't have listened anyway. To which the force of justice says to God, you know they wouldn't have listened. I know they wouldn't have listened. But these people don't know that they wouldn't have listened. They're responsible to try. And at that point, unfortunately, the story doesn't have a happy ending. Both groups get punished. Both the people who sinned and the people who didn't sin. They don't live happily ever after. But out of that grows a debate about reading people's minds and what your obligation is. So that in source number 11, the line from Tosfot is that you are not obligated I'm not going to read it from inside. You can see it there, though. He says, where they're definitely not going to accept what you have to say, leave them alone. Better that they should be sinning accidentally rather than intentionally, which is a principle that we're going to have to talk about later. But the point that I'm bringing here is his first point, that if they're not going to accept, you leave them alone. Whereas, in source number 12, Nimuka Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Ibn Habib, says try once. He says, try once. In number one, because they might listen. And number two, because otherwise they can say, well, of course I sinned. No one ever told me any different. So this way, they can't make that argument. So we actually may be responsible to rebuke. That we may have a responsibility for at least once. The principle of better that they sin accidentally rather than intentionally applies only to certain areas of Jewish law. It applies specifically to laws that are not stated explicitly in the Torah. Meaning, if something is not explicit in the Torah, then you have the idea of don't let it, better that he should be violating accidentally. If something is explicit in the Torah, it says don't steal, and he's going around stealing, then he can't say it's accidental because everybody knows you're not supposed to steal. So there's some nuance there. But in terms of what we're saying now and summarizing what we've said, in our case, in which Sarah, the accountant, was asked for tax advice, and she gave tax advice, and she gets the sense that her friend is going to do something inappropriate, going to do something improper. So there's no issue of lifnei iver not to cause her to stumble, because she gave proper advice. That's not my concern. There may be an issue of an obligation to rebuke, or to keep people from sinning. Those issues may well apply. However, they won't apply if her friend is not Jewish, and they may not apply if the violation would be intentional with full knowledge. I may have an obligation to rebuke once, just to make sure that it's said, since I don't really know what she's going to do. Then I may have that obligation, but that's really it. Are we clear on the first case? Because now it gets harder. This was the easy one. Okay. Let's move on to the second case. This case I titled, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Sam. Yes?
Judge, can I ask one quick question on the first case? Based on the pasuk, just reading the low season, the juxtaposition, do not hate your brother, but rebuke your friend, it would seem, I don't know what the idea would be behind it, but that intention or what you're feeling or what you should feel in some way should play in or must play in whether you rebuke or how you rebuke. In other words, by saying, do not hate your brother, what does it have to do with whether you hate, you love him? I would think that actually plays in, so perhaps that's another issue that has to go into the
love aspect of it.
Interesting. If you're not going to do it, if you're not going to, if you're doing it, if you're calling the person off because you dislike them or because
right.
One
motives,
your motives may be important.
Right. Motives are definitely important. One is not allowed, and that's I was thinking about it as I prepared this, but just realized there was no time to really flesh it out. But absolutely, the commentators say that rebuke, which is born out of animosity, and which is delivered with a feeling of animosity, is not halachically rebuke. That you didn't fulfill the mitzvah.
Which I think is called right and written.
Yeah, correct.
Do not hate them, love them, therefore rebuke them.
Correct. Okay, so here's the case. Sam, a certified tax accountant, is preparing Jill's taxes. Jill provides receipts for significant donations to CRA-recognized charities. Her gifts total 20% of her income, and my goal in presenting that is to say this is a person who is giving a lot away, more than what people normally give. When Sam notes she's giving tuition, but that's a side discussion. When Sam notes the remarkable level of Jill's giving, she responds with a wink and a grin. So what could a wink and a grin mean? I'm sitting here in an accounting firm. What can a wink and a grin mean?
We're happy to see him.
Yes. It could mean it's not legit. It could mean that there's something funny going on here, that she has a receipt for a gift she didn't give. Or it could mean she's happy and just having a great day. Is Sam obligated to pursue this? Now, here, we've changed some things. What's the difference between this and the previous case?
You used less obviously Jewish names.
That wasn't on purpose.
He's acting as a professional.
Yeah.
There is a professional obligation, and he has risk also.
mm-hmm. professional risk.
Right.
And there's an implicit wink and a smile.
Which that, there, and therefore?
Well, Sarah just asked for advice, which she did. Was, you know, we're not quite certain what happened after we suggested our... But right. here there's sort of a lead on to...
Right. There's an indication that something's up.
Right.
True. But you're a participant, and you mentioned risk, so I'm not clear on the specifics of whether the accountant is signing that he knows everything is true, or the accountant is signing, based on the documents given to me, this is all accurate. I mean, can someone actually answer that for me? Is the accountant certifying I investigated, or is
no,
the accountant
didn't have to investigate.
Okay,
whatever's there is there.
So he's just saying, given the papers in front of me.
Right, but if he knows, if he's aware of something that's clearly he should have questioned, like if it becomes something that he should have, you expect him to have questioned, he has an obligation, professional obligation, to question it. He can't be party to something that he should have known. Was inappropriate.
Well, let's say she hadn't done the whole wink and grin thing. Okay? Let's say the gifts total 20% of her income. Sam says, wow, you're benevolent. And she says, aw, shucks. You know, we're just nice people. Does he have an obligation to go further?
No.
Okay. So, the now that it wasn't simply the sheepish, yeah, we're really benevolent people, but it's actually... she's given some indication that something is up. From a Jewish ethical perspective, is there an obligation to pursue it, separate from any professional obligation? So the issue here certainly still involves everything we discussed in the first case. The issue of tochacha, rebuking, is still here. The issue of afrusha me'isira, keeping people from sinning, is still here. But now we add a level of complexity, which is what's called either machazik yidei ovrei avera, literally grabbing the hand of, holding the hand of someone who is sinning, or misayeya, which means to assist. And again, it's about our basic role as Jews. How should I, as the accountant in this case, strengthen somebody who I believe is doing something wrong? Right? How could I do that? On the other hand, I'm a member of society. Am I now meant to go around telling everybody what they should do? So take a look at source number 13, please. Gemara in Bava Kamma. Ein lo chin min haroim. I think it's actually a Mishnah. Ein lo chin min haroim lo izim velo gidim velo gizin velo tzlushin shal tzemer. You can't purchase goats, kids, young goats, wool, tufts of wool from shepherds. The system of shepherds that they had was that you, as an owner of a flock, would assign the sheep to somebody who would take them several days out, graze them for a while, and then bring them back in. So the shepherd doesn't have a right to the products of the sheep. The shepherd does not have the right to decide he's going to go into shearing the wool and selling it. So therefore, if somebody sees a shepherd selling goats, knowing this is a professional shepherd, this is not someone who has his own flock, he can't go buy from the shepherd. Avalokin mehen tefurin. He could buy clothing that's already been stitched. Mivneshein shalahen, because that's his own stuff. Velokin mehen chalav ugavina bamidbar velo b'yishuv. You can purchase milk and cheese from him out in the wild, but not in urban areas. And the idea here, as the commentators explain, is that by agreement, the shepherds were allowed to use the milk because they're going days out. They're not going to bring the milk back home. So the shepherds were licensed to traffic in that if they were out in the wilderness, as opposed to when they're back near home. So I'm not allowed to buy items that I think might be stolen. That's fundamentally what we're saying here. There are other cases, but I think this is a decent case to support the idea that you're not allowed to aid those who are sinning. And if you take a look at source number 14, you find Rambam Maimonides codifying this in Hilchos Gezeila, the laws of robbery. Others bring this as well. I just brought his because it's a nice, succinct presentation. He says, Asur liknos davar hagazul min hagazlan. He says, you're not allowed to purchase stolen goods from a thief. Right. Well, that's the offense. You may be the enemy. You may be the consumer. Right. Shekala osed devarim elu. But watch what he says. Shekala osed devarim elu. Because one who does these things, and that these things include some things I excluded just for space reasons, but this and similar things. Makayotze Bahen. Mechazek Yidei Ovrei Avera. One who does this is violating the principle of aiding sinners, strengthening the hand of the sinner. Va'over av lifnei iver, lo siten mechshol. And by the way, there's this issue of lifnei iver that we talked about. You're causing him to stumble. Not in the sense that he doesn't know stealing is wrong, but in the sense that he wouldn't steal if he didn't know he has someone who's going to buy it off him. He's not stealing it because he needs to have 10 stereos. He's stealing it because he knows that 10 people are going to want to buy stereos from him. No purchaser, no theft. So therefore, you are considered to be aiding and abetting. That's the issue. But it's more than just buying it off him. It's not limited to that. Take a look at source number 15, please. This is dealing with the sabbatical laws, the laws of Shemitah. During the sabbatical year, every seventh year, one is not supposed to work land in Israel. Instead, you open your gates and say, anybody who wants to come in can come in and take whatever grows wild. That you're allowed to have, but you can't cultivate anything. So, they're talking about here a case in which you know people who are going to violate those laws. They're not doing the whole Shemitah thing, this whole sabbatical year thing. They're going to plant grain, they're going to grow it, they're going to grind it, and they're going to bake it, the whole bit. They come to you and say, listen, my sifter broke. Can you lend me your sifter? And you know full well what they're going to do with it. So, that's the case here in number 15. Mash'elas isha l'chaverta ha'chashuda al ha'shviyiz, nafa u'kvara v'rechayim v'tanur. A woman may lend her friend who is suspected of violating Shemitah, she can lend her the sifter, the sieve, the mill. I wrote strainer on here, but that's a mistake in the translation. The Rechaim is a mill. The tanur, an oven. Avalo tavor avalo titchan ima. The limit is she can't actually sift the stuff with her. She can't grind the grain with her. She can't engage in the act, but she can lend it to her. Why? Shein machzikin yidei ovrei avera, because you can't strengthen the hands of those who sin. V'chulon lo amru elam b'nei darkei shalom. And the whole fact that we permit you to do anything is simply because of peace. You want peaceful relations with people. Therefore, we're going to say you can lend to her, but you can't actually engage in the activity. And as part of this, brought in the Gemara and Gin, brought in this this source as well, and a part that I didn't include, they even say you can't encourage people as they do this prohibited work, saying, oh, I hope it turns out well. So you're there in the sabbatical year. You yourself are not farming your field. This other person is farming. You can't say to that to the farmer, you know, I hope that the crops grow nicely. You can say, have a nice day. That's fine. You can be, I meant that in a polite way. You can be polite and friendly, but you can't say, I hope that the wheat is plentiful this year. That's beyond. I'm not supposed to encourage people when they sin. So if I were to stop with that, I would say, Sam has an obligation to pursue it. He has an obligation to say, you can't do this, you're not allowed to file that, let's go look at these receipts more carefully. Note, though, that there may be some exceptions here, too.
Why would you be forced to say that? Because what it seems like we're saying, and this applies to the first question, but also is that this is we're not worried. We understand that you can't do the wrong thing with the person, right? You can't actually break the law, but we said the word chashuda here, you know, you use the word, she winked, she grinned. This is all, you know, ambiguous acts of, in other words, this is all just suspected.
Correct.
Suspected things. So in that case, it seems like we're saying that we're just, in other words, if, I think the Gemara would have said here, if you know 100%, the person is going to take these tools and use it to violate Shemitah, you wouldn't be allowed to do it. But it just says here, it says Isha Chashuda, just that you have some suspicion of it.
Right, and it's still saying I can't engage in it.
But I can lend it to her. I can
lend it to her, right. Right, and maybe I could give her the link for online filing. But I can't actually be the accountant who's going to file the forms. I think that's what he's saying.
The accountant's benefiting from the relationship. He gets paid to do it. In this,
right.
In the case of lending, specifically, you will not benefit from the activity.
Right. The issue of taking money for it is one that I want to get to next week. Because we'll see some cases like that there. But absolutely, this person is party to what's being done. However, there is room for now. Number one, even with the wink and the grin and all that, you don't know that she is cheating. So could I argue that as long as you don't know, you're okay? Take a look, please, at source number 16. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says, codifying what we already saw in number 14, Kol davar shechez kaso shehu ganuv. Anything which is presumed stolen, asur likach oso, you can't purchase it. And what he means by that, as explained by the commentators there, is it's the type of thing that tends to be stolen. So, for example, I'm walking on the streets in Manhattan, and some guy has a stand out there with, you know, 100 watches saying Rolex, R-O-L-E-K-S, or whatever. R-O-L-E-S. And the, you know, these are things that we assume are stolen. I don't know anything about that individual watch. I don't know where it came from. I don't know that this particular one, or even this particular stand,
is stolen.
Maybe it's fake, which may violate other laws. But the point is, I don't need to know about this item. It's sufficient that I know that things of this nature tend to be stolen. That's enough to already keep me away. He says, if most such things are stolen, you're not allowed to purchase it. I'm sorry, I'm going to come back to that in 1 second. So that's number one. I don't have to know she's cheating. If I know that that what's going on for most people when they give this kind of a signal is that they are cheating, that's good enough for me to know that this is a problem. There is another point, though, here, which is I'm only responsible to avoid involvement if my involvement makes the sin profitable or otherwise encourages it to happen. In other words, it's entirely possible that my involvement isn't changing a thing. I only need to refrain if I am the one who's really enabling this to happen by making it something that someone will do. If you take a look at source 17, that may clarify it further. Rishner Zalman of Liadi in the Shulchan Aruch Harav, he was the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. So he wrote the following: Asur liknos me'aganav hachefet sheganav. You're not allowed to purchase from a thief that which he stole. Va'avon gadolu. He says it's a great sin. Shari mafziki deyovei avera. You are strengthening the hand of those who sin. And then he continues, that we already knew, but he continues, Ve'alzen ne'amar, regarding this, the sentence in Mishlei in Proverbs says, Cholekin ganav sonei nafsho. One who splits, meaning split property with a thief, hates his life. Ve'gorim lo lignov ginevos acheros, because you're going to cause him to steal again. Shem lo yimza lo keach, because if he can't find purchasers, eino gonev, he doesn't steal. He understood the criminal mind. Granted that this thief could also go somewhere else, right? You'll say, well, they'll find another accountant, right? So therefore I should be okay, because it could find another accountant. This thief could also find some other person to purchase the stolen goods. It's not that available. So he's introducing a gradation here, right? The gradation is, how available are the other options? It's not so available for him to go somewhere else where no one's going to know him. He's got to travel in order to be able to fence the goods. That's not considered to be such an available option for him. Vim kol yoda v'makirav lo yiknu mimenu lo yiknu v'kolkach. So people who know him won't buy. He won't steal as much. So writes the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. So therefore, based on what he's saying, if what I am doing is not materially changing things for him, I'm not enabling him, because he would do it anyway. Maybe there's an argument to say, I can let this go and not pursue it. Because of that. There's also another possibility, which I'm not entirely clear how to apply in this case, but I had to mention it. And that is, we distinguish between when you help. I'll give you an example. Let's say you have a neighbor who grows wheat. And they grew the wheat. This isn't an ideal case. I'm going to give you the non-ideal case. I'm going to give you the ideal case, even though it's not as relevant in practice today. There is a prohibition against rendering certain produce tame, impure. So what if I have a neighbor who doesn't care about purity and impurity and grew the stuff, cut it, harvested it, and made it impure because they didn't care. Am I allowed to help in later stages of the processing where the sin has already taken place? The sin's over. Nothing is happening at this point. The violation's already taken place. Is it a problem for me to help later on? The parallel here would be, her lie was in declaring that she has, I'm making up a number, $20,000 in charitable deductions. Right? That's her lie. I am coming in after that. She's already written that on the form, and now I'm just taking care of everything else in terms of submitting this thing. So could I argue that my involvement is after the fact? Take a look at source number 18. Rashi commenting on this issue of Shemitah. Rashi says, V'chulam lo amru she'itiru l'hash'ilam kelim l'sayam belo sha'as avera atzma elam ipnei darkei shalom. He says, the fact that we permit you to lend implements, right, and help when they are not performing the actual sin is for the sake of pursuing peace. So in other words, Rashi is indicating, and the Ksav Sofer, who I quoted before in source number 6, so he makes a statement, not in number 6 itself, but he makes a statement in general, that I am allowed to aid when the prohibition is not actually taking place. I can be involved in parts of this process and just not be involved in what I consider to be the violation itself. And this position is taken by other contemporaries and those who followed Rashi's time as well.
So the practical implication of that, for example, is if the person, some people will provide you with a list of charitable donations, yeah, along with other information, say, prepare my return. You don't actually get the slips, and you don't actually go through the slips. They don't ask you for anything about the slips. They just give you that information. Now, even if that would be where, if that's where the illegitimate receipts were, you could say, well, I'm doing the return, but I didn't really get involved with the mistake.
Exactly.
She provided that information after. And I'm involved after that.
Exactly.
That makes sense from an accounting point of view, too. So it protects your liability.
Also, what's the obligation to go back if it's a new client and their former accountant cheated and they knew about it, they were happy about it, and then they come to you and you say, listen, I can't be part of that. They're okay with it, but they, you know for sure that in prior years they're error.
Right. So again, the same principle will apply. You're coming in after the fact.
Right.
Now, I want to stress something here very carefully. We're dealing here with a question of bottom line obligation, not with being a good person in general. So in other words, I am, what were the names in this case? I'm Sam, the accountant, and Jill presented me with a figure without showing me individual receipts, and I'm thinking this looks a little funny, but whatever transgression has occurred already. That's now done, if I can make that argument. I'm not 100% sure you can, because maybe you could argue the transgression isn't complete until it's filed. That's why I'm a little bit loath to apply this. But the argument could be, or you know what, I'll use Dory's case, right? It was from the past. This is something that was about returns that were filed years ago. So in such a case, I'm coming in after the fact. Letter of the law, I believe, to sum up what we've said, is I am not called a machzik yedei over avera. I am not aiding and abetting the sin, and I have no obligation to open it up. That doesn't mean that I shouldn't. It could be that this is an appropriate thing to do, but in terms of what my obligation is, Sam has no obligation to go further and open this up. If he knows about stuff and his actions are going to take that further, that's another story. But otherwise, he's not obligated to do so. So to go back to our vignettes, number one, Sarah with her friend, it seems, number one, if her friend is not Jewish, so she can't mislead her into sinning, into doing something wrong. But she is not obligated to go the extra mile of saying, and I'm going to compel you to do what's right. Number two, we said, if her friend is violating intentionally, which it seems like from that case, Sarah's obligation is over. She gave her the proper information. She may have to offer one level of don't do this, but that's it. And then in our case, the second case of Sam and...
And she steps out of the engagement?
Well, she's not engaged. That was the non-professional advice case. There was no... She's not a participant.
But if you take it next...
Right, so now the second case, the Sam case, is now where he's engaged to actually do it. So in terms of what we added here about machzik yedei over avera, he cannot be someone who will aid in the activity. He can't aid the activity, but we still have to go back to our first point about Afrushe Me'i Sira and Tochacha. If he believes that something is going on here that's wrong, right? He may have an obligation to say something once, right? Under rebuke, and say, hey, you're not supposed to do this, in order to make sure that that is stated explicitly, that this is not considered appropriate behavior. That may well be, that may well remain as a as an obligation for him.
You would say he might have an obligation to say it once, but she winked and everything, and he really thinks something fishy. He's just, that seems to be a cop-out, just that he's saying it once. He thinks there's something wrong, and it hasn't happened in the past. She's telling him right now, basically, or giving him that indication. So he could say, at least ask to say, not to panic. Ask the question, are these legit or are they not legit? And now, if she misleads him,
right,
then you can say, okay.
Right, but I think that...
If he doesn't ask the question, are these legit, when he is given that specific body language, not an inference like the first case, I don't know how you can say if something happened in the past that she brought him, it's still in the present.
To which I would say it's not a matter of that. I think it's because this person is doing it intentionally. There's no difference between your rebuke once and your rebuke 100 times. You're not going to change his mind. You do it once because it should be stated, for whatever reason that Tosos mentioned, whether so that he can't say no one told me. Avrusha Meisura only is, we said, if it's actually going to work, right? That was Rabbi Yalev Ginsburg in source number 10. He said, if the guy's not going to listen to you, then you're not being Avrusha Meisura. You're not keeping him from sinning.
Well, maybe... Next account he's going to go to is not going to do it either. He's going to get the impression that nobody's going to do it for him, so he better not present those to the accountant.
Wish you were right.
You his head spending a few bucks.
I just question the translation in number 16.
Yeah.
Kol davar she'azakta shugadim.
Shechas kasa ganim. Yeah.
Presumed stolen.
Yeah, that's the chazaka. It's presumed. That's why.
When I see a chazaka, I think a chazaka is meaning, I guess, like the more general Talmudic definition of chazaka. Isn't this really well established? There's an idea of chazaka that testifies, 3 years you take possession of a property, so that it's something that's yadua, it's something that's the entire community knows about, and therefore it's.
Right, and the word presumes. The word chazaka does get used in different ways in the Gemara, but. The term itself doesn't have a great one-word translation. It's something which is commonly considered to be stolen. Would probably be a better thing than presumed, because presumed sounds a little lighter.
Well, to read those words, I would read those words as something that it's known, it's stolen. And in fact, I think the latter part of the second part would actually test it also, because the chenim robos, in other words, the latter part saying it, and even if it's not a chazak, even if it's not known that it's stolen, but it's part of something that's known.
Right.
So what
he's doing here is, in the first half, he's talking about the item proper. If there's a specific item, it's a vase, and it's presumed to be stolen, meaning that vase, that's not a vase that's out there on the open market. The owner isn't selling that. If that's there, we believe that it's stolen. That's the first half.
Right.
The second half is where something is in a class of items, and the assumption is that items in that class are stolen. But either way, it's not a case of knowledge. It's not yadua. It's not something that's
I would just say that this halacha would seem to, for our vignettes that we have here, would seem to imply, again, that really your obligation only goes in as much as when something is really well established, not a wink or a nod or anything else, some type of other, little let-on
So I don't think it needs to be that. As long as what they did normally would lead a person to conclude this is what's going on. That's the way I see it. I would be glad for follow-up questions by email, as always, and I will, God willing, send out maybe some follow-up on this. There are a couple of things that are outstanding that I'd like to be able to revisit. Maybe we'll see. We'll see how the week goes. But God willing, next Wednesday we get part 2 with some more challenging vignettes. Thank you.